Sounds good. Thanks.
Good morning. Energy and Climate Finance will come to order. We have minutes of February 7th. Representative Christensen, would you move those minutes of February 7th?
We have quorum.
I move the minutes from February 7th, Madam Chair.
I think we don't have a quorum yet. We'll wait for a second on that. We'll have your motion here, but we'll wait for that until we have a quorum. Today, we are going to go over some of our base budgets that will come to us shortly with the governor's budget. We're not asking for budget numbers now, but to understand what we will be funding and to ground ourselves in what the agencies are doing, and so we can make good decisions. I always think good information makes good decisions. With that, I will welcome Commissioner Kelly, and he will introduce his deputy commissioner and others. Thank you for coming this morning.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to be with you this morning. I'm Steve Kelly. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Commerce. We plan as a team to give you a brief overview of the department with a focus on the areas related to this committee's jurisdiction. And so I will... So just briefly, the mission of the department is to protect the public interest, advocate for Minnesota consumers, ensure a strong, competitive, and fair marketplace, strengthen Minnesota's economic future, and serve as a trusted public resource for consumers and businesses. The department is relatively small. We have about 345 full-time employees. But we regulate over 22 industries. We license about 350,000 professionals and businesses. We provide consumer assistance. We conduct fraud investigations, advocate for the public interest before regulatory bodies, deliver federal and state energy and telecommunications programs, and ensure equitable commercial and financial transactions and reliable utility service. So here's the structure of the department at this point. With me today are John Kelly, Legislative Liaison, our Director of Government Affairs, Megan Verdeja. And I am now, after this very brief introduction, going to turn this over to the representatives of our Division of Energy Resources and our Petro Fund and Finance people. So Joe Sullivan is the Deputy Commissioner for Energy Resources, who started last week. And our new Assistant Commissioner for Energy Resources is Catherine Blauvelt. And then the Director of the Petro Fund Program, Joel Fisher, is here. And our Chief Financial Officer, Tim Janke, will help with the budget portion of the presentation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. We'll start with Deputy Commissioner Joe Sullivan, and if you'd put your name on the record, we'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Sullivan. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Division of Energy Resources at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Thank you for having us here today to give a presentation on the Division of Energy Resources. The division, as you can see here in the slide, is comprised of five main functions, including the Energy Planning and Advocacy Unit, the State Energy Office, Energy Assistance, Energy Environmental Review and Analysis, as well as the Telecommunications Unit. Our mission and responsibilities include advocating on behalf of consumers and ratepayers in proceedings involving regulated utilities, maintaining state emergency energy planning and recovery plans, overseeing the Conservation Improvement Program, which is operated by more than 140 Minnesota utilities, promoting energy-efficient buildings, alternative fuels, and modern energy techniques or technologies and then also administering the low-income home energy assistance and weatherization assistance programs. So turning to slide six, this is our energy regulation and planning unit. These folks are PhD economists and accountants, and the energy regulation and planning unit ensures that electric and gas utilities provide reliable and reasonably priced service with minimal impacts on the environment while managing many other risks. Some of the responsibilities of this unit include, if we go to slide seven, intervening on the public's behalf in all matters before the Public Utilities Commission, which relate to reliability, costs, and the soundness of natural gas and electric service. Investigating matters involving utility service reliability, financial issues, costs of capital, sales forecasts, energy conservation, and many other technical issues. This unit analyzes our utilities' integrated resource plans, their certificate of needs for large energy facilities. They analyze our rate cases, each of our utilities' rate cases, rider filings like the conservation rider, and many, many other issues and filings. The ERP, some of the successes of this unit include, and I think this is really critically important that folks understand this, that the ERP's analysis and investigation into utilities' proposed rate increases have saved customers of investor-owned utilities in Minnesota since 2010 $1.4 billion. So this unit has more than paid for itself through the savings on ratepayers' bills and customers' bills. ERP has ensured that electric and gas service is reliable, even during extreme weather events like the polar vortex that we've just recently been through. And really very important is the long-range planning that this unit does. The analysis that they've done in electric utilities resource plans has resulted in cost-effective, reliable resources with fewer emissions through the long-range planning that they do. Moving on now to slide eight, this is our State Energy Office. The State Energy Office helps Minnesota achieve its clean energy goals by accelerating the use of energy efficiency and renewable energy practices, by providing weatherization assistance to low-income households, by informing decision makers with accurate information on clean energy technologies and resources, by supplying assistance to local units of government, businesses, and residents about best practices for efficient and safe buildings. Moving on to the next slide, some of the responsibilities of this unit include providing oversight to the more than $300 million in federal and utility dollars that are spent on energy efficiency and renewable energy. They provide oversight for our 140 utilities in the conservation plans that they implement. The Energy Office administers the low-income weatherization assistance program. We provide policy, program, data, and technical expertise for the clean energy community. Critically, we maintain the state emergency energy planning and recovery plans, and we educate residents and businesses through our Energy Information Center. Some of the accomplishments of this unit are coordinating the more than $50 million in federal dollars for energy efficiency and renewable energy projects and initiatives that are benefiting Minnesota. I think it's really important to note that in 2007, this is the office, energy office, that presided over according to ACEEE, the fourth ranked in the country, most effective conservation improvement program. We're very proud of that. In the last 2 years, our office has awarded clean energy community grant awards to more than 15 communities throughout Minnesota for their contributions in meeting state energy goals. Critically, this office provides every year, more than 2,000 low-income households with comprehensive weatherization assistance, which on average lowers these customers and these individuals' energy bills by 30% or more. So it's a significant savings for them with their energy burden. And also, I think it is really critically important that this energy office provides technical expertise to the emerging clean energy economy, which, as you all know and have heard in the last month, is a large source of our growth. The clean energy economy grew last year by 16.5%. So with that, I'm going to hand it off to our Assistant Commissioner, Catherine Blauvelt, and thank you so much for your time, and I'll be prepared to answer any questions.
Before we go to the next person, are there questions? I do want you, if you would, repeat the amount of money that your office has saved during rate cases. I thought that was significant.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the energy regulation analysis has saved ratepayers in Minnesota about $1.4 billion, a little bit more than $1.4 billion since 2010.
Since 2010.
Since 2010.
Thank you for that. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Catherine Blauvelt, Assistant Commissioner for the Division of Energy Resources at the Commerce Department. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I should point out the department's telecom unit also falls under the Division of Energy Resources and under my purview, but of course it's outside of the scope of this presentation today, so I won't go into detail. But I'll start with the Energy Assistance Program. This helps, of course, address some of the immediate impacts and also root causes of household poverty. And it does that by directly reducing households' energy burdens, resolving immediate energy crises by households, and conducting activities that reduce long-term energy needs by homes. So how does it do that? It provides oversight to over $115 million every year in annual energy assistance payments to energy vendors statewide. And you see some statistics there on the slide. Sort of cumulatively, since 1980, this program has helped nearly 4.7 million households. And it's managed over $3.3 billion in that same time period. And just in this past federal fiscal year, 2018, you'll see the Energy Assistance Program served over 126,000 households, over 320,000 people. And I will name there specifically the vast majority of benefits went to Greater Minnesota, around 70%. And you'll see the breakdown there. We have a breakdown for households with young children, but we also had over 47,000 households with seniors served and over 52,000 households with people with disabilities. And again, the breakout is Greater Minnesota saw the majority of those benefits. All right, the next unit is the Energy Environmental Review and Analysis Unit. This directs all aspects of environmental review and permitting of large energy projects, such as high voltage transmission lines, large electric power generating plants, large wind energy conversion systems and pipelines on behalf of the Public Utilities Commission. So the EERA provides three major roles for that commission regarding environmental impact statements, right, and other similar review processes. And those roles are project management, technical analyses, and public involvement facilitation. And I should say the unit also participates in the state's long-range planning and policy development processes. Go to the next slide. So its responsibilities are to fulfill the Public Utilities Commission responsibilities under the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act. It serves as the Department of Commerce's technical representative to the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board, and it provides other technical expertise and assistance to the commission for activities and proceedings under Minnesota statutes 216E, 216F, and 216G. And just to note a few recent accomplishments and work of this unit, it has led the discussion on new process requirements that are necessary for repowering or retooling large wind energy project installations, and it's reviewed the potential impacts of 6 proposed wind energy projects, 3 natural gas pipelines, and 3 high voltage transmission lines. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, John Kelly, Government Affairs Liaison for the Department. We're now going to turn it over to Joel Fisher, the Executive Director of the Petro Fund.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As John said, my name is Joel Fisher. I'm the Director of the Petro Fund Program. I'm just going to give you a brief explanation of what the Petro Fund does. Our main goal is to protect human health, welfare, and the environment of the state of Minnesota. And the 2 main ways we do that are we have a reimbursement program and an abandoned underground storage tank removal assessment program. I'll start with the reimbursement program. The Petro Fund provides 90% reimbursement to eligible applicants for their costs to investigate and clean up contamination from leaking petroleum storage tanks. Since 1987, we have addressed about 13,000 sites across the state and provided about $450 million. And eligible applicants could be anything from petroleum retailers to other businesses with gas tanks or fuel oil tanks, homeowners, farmers, schools, other government entities. We also provide funding, or the Petro Fund program also provides funding to the Pollution Control Agency for their petroleum remediation program, tank compliance program, their emergency response program. Most of that funding goes also to pay for investigation and cleanup of sites where there's no viable responsible person out there. Go to the next slide. An example of something we do is the New Prague School District. We had a site where they removed 2 10,000-gallon fuel oil tanks. Contamination was discovered, and 150 cubic yards of contaminated soil was removed and disposed of. Insurance didn't cover any of those costs, and so the Petro Fund stepped in. We reimbursed 90%, which was about $5,700. So the school was able to use those funds to educate the kids and also protect the school buildings from vapors and that sort of thing by getting that soil out of there. Our second program we do is the Abandoned Underground Storage Tank Removal Program. In this case, we actually try and prevent releases as much as possible. The Petro Fund uses our own contractors to go out and remove abandoned tanks at properties where someone has, usually they've discovered a tank that they didn't know was there. Our main goal there was we want to get those tanks out and remove as much product as we can before it gets into the environment, or if it already has leaked, we can then find the leak and address it and get the investigation and cleanup going. And since 2004, when the program was created, we've removed over 500 abandoned tanks at about 330 sites. And there was in those tanks, there was about 230,000 gallons of petroleum and sludge and water that we were able to get out before it got into the environment. And I have a quick example of a project we had recently. There was the city of Forest Lake. They were doing a utility project, and they ran into 2 fuel oil tanks, one 560-gallon and one 500-gallon fuel oil tank that had about 405 gallons of fuel oil, water, and sludge in it. We think that it was from a gas station that went out of business in about the 1950s. And so there is no party that is going to take those tanks out. And so we were able to identify, get the tanks out, and it's about a block away from Forest Lake. There was some contamination, but at least we were also able to start the investigation and clean it before it got to the lake. The last item I just want to let the board know is we are housed in the Department of Commerce, and I report to Commissioner Kelly, but we also have a 5-member board that oversees the Petro Fund. It's made up of a petroleum industry member, an insurance industry member, a public member, and then the commissioners of Commerce and the Pollution Control Agency. The most visible thing the board does is when we make our reimbursement determinations as a staff, applicants have an opportunity to appeal those determinations if they don't agree with them, and the board reviews those appeals and makes the final determination on those cases. So that's all I have at the moment. Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Madam Chair, members, we're next going to have our Chief Financial Officer, Tim Janke, come up and do some base budget slides.
Before we switch here, Representative, did you have a question for this witness?
I did. If you don't mind, you'll take just a second. Thank you so much, Madam Chair.
That's fine.
I had a question about the abandoned underground tank program. And when is a tank considered abandoned? And you talked about an old gas station that went out of business in the 50s. In my community, there's a gas station that went out of business several years ago and has been repurposed into a restaurant in the existing building, and the tanks haven't been removed. So when are those tanks considered abandoned?
Madam Chair, members, there are two criteria. One is if the tank was taken out of service prior to December 22, 1988, it qualifies. Or if the tanks were taken out of service after that point, but the applicant, the property owner, can show that they had no knowledge of the tanks when they took title to the property, they also couldn't qualify.
Just to follow up. So then if they obviously knew the tanks were there, they aren't abandoned and it would be their responsibility to, okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. Thanks.
You're correct.
Representative Baker.
Madam Chair, actually, I have a question for Deputy Sullivan when he gets, if he wants to come back or if you want to do it after the CFO presentation. I wanted to get your call on that. So
let's
thank you.
Finish with this witness and then we'll.
Thank you.
So Representative Mahoney.
Madam Chair, I have a number of questions for the about the tanks, and I can certainly wait till the end of the testimony if that's how you want to do it, or I've got a series of questions.
I think this is an appropriate time for.
So I want to make sure, Mr. Fisher, how do you prioritize which tanks to take out? I mean, do you have to do that at all, or do, when somebody calls you, it's like, oh no, I got money in the bank, I'll go do it?
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, we don't really have to prioritize. We have enough funding to address all the tanks. We don't get that many tanks that call in. So let's say last year, I think we removed like 40, 50 tanks. The Petrofund Board sets aside $300,000 a year for the tank removals, and we don't spend quite that much generally in a year. So there is plenty of funding for that.
How do you do, Madam Chair? Where do your funds come from?
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, the Petrofund is funded by a 2 cent per gallon fee that's imposed whenever our unencumbered balance drops below $4 million. When that happens, I go to the Petrofund Board and inform the board. It's their responsibility then to inform the Department of Revenue to impose the fee. And once the fee is turned on, it goes on for 4 months and then it turns off automatically. We are right now probably about 4 out of every 14 to 15 months the fee is turned on.
Madam Chair, who set the $4 million? That may be way before your time, but.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, that was set back at the beginning of the program back in the late 80s, early 90s. So, yeah, it was before my time. I'm assuming that was with discussions with the stakeholders and legislature that they came up with that figure.
Madam Chair, one more question and then maybe a comment. Do you, Mr. Fisher, many of these sites, in my district, many of these sites are in highly commercialized corners. Because they have some contamination and stuff to them, they're not being put to their highest valued use. You know, no one wants to put a medical clinic next to a site that's had a tank or does have a tank on it that has leaked. I've got one big square block that we just can't seem to market because everybody goes, well, you've got all these pumps catching the vapors and stuff that we can't get out of the soil. So my question is, do you, when you're removing these tanks, take into consideration the commercialized value of that particular site and make sure that it's clean enough for not so much residential, because they're primarily commercial areas, so the zoning wouldn't fall into play, or the zoning would fall into play. You know, how clean do you have to make these? How do you work with DEED? And it's economic development groups or the city's economic development groups. How does that particular process work? Because this is, you know, what I am finding not only in my district, but when I drive around the state, a lot of these sites are either on the main street of a small town or in my case, in a highly trafficked, of course, I think the one street, the one that really, you know, gnaws at me has got about 50,000 cars going by it every day, and it's sat vacant for ages. So who do you work with when you, other than just the tank, the landowners and your agency?
Chair, Representative Mahoney. This kind of illustrates, this would be a classic case of where we work with the Pollution Control Agency and DEED as well. So the first thing, from a Petro Fund standpoint, we handle the financial side. We work very closely with Pollution Control Agency staff. They determine what the appropriate corrective action is out of the site, so how much investigation and cleanup occurs. Minnesota is a state, the different states have different philosophies, but Minnesota, we do use risk-based corrective action. And so when they do the investigation, they figure out what are the potential risks to the receptors, like drinking water, buildings for vapors, human health, and that. And they clean it up to whatever the current use of the property is. So if it's a gas station, they clean it up to the level of a gas station. If it's a home, they clean it up to the levels that are appropriate for a home. If a property owner wants to redevelop the property to a higher level, that typically is not eligible for reimbursement from the Petra Fund. We typically don't reimburse redevelopment or development-related costs. The legislature did create back in 2004, I believe, the Contaminated Cleanup and Investigation Grant Program over at DEED, where they set aside $6.2 million a year that goes over to DEED from the Petra Fund that cities actually working with developers can use Petra Fund money to clean up properties to a higher level. And so you can apply for a grant. So one, the city in your district could apply for a grant through DEED to cover, it would be a, basically investigation and cleanup to the level of whatever the need may be. Usually, though, there, it has to do with tax base and creating jobs and that sort of thing. So a homeowner typically is not going to qualify for those grants. But we do work closely with both the MPCA and DEED to try and address those kind of sites. It's not uncommon to have sites where we have Petro Fund money and DEED money both going toward it.
Thank you.
Before we... Representative Mahoney, is you're finished?
I am. Thank you.
Okay. Before we bring back Deputy Commissioner Sullivan, let's hear from the Chief Financial Officer, who is the last one on our agenda from the Department of Commerce.
Madam Chair, welcome. Members of the committee, Tim Janke, Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Commerce. In the first slide that you'll see up here, you'll see that as a whole, this is really looking at commerce as a whole, expenditures for the department. We're looking at fiscal year 18 actual expenditures here. You can see that in the lower right-hand corner, there's a cutout there that's showing the petrol fund expenditures, roughly $5.77 million. Were expended for petrol fund activities. That includes their operations as well as claims and the underground storage tank removals that Joel was just talking about. On the upper left side is the larger orange section of the chart, which includes the Division of Energy Resources, which is 74% of the overall Department of Commerce budget. Expenditures in FY18 were about $148 million. Primarily, this comes from federal funds, which accounted for about $131 million of that total, $148 million. Next slide, Joel. The next slide shows revenues for the whole department, for commerce as a whole. In FY18, the total revenues are shown here as $308 million. Petro Fund is a small portion of that because they get the revenue transferred in from the Department of Revenue for the fee. This is really just showing the kind of the interest and other small dollars that they get in revenue. The Division of Energy Resources receives approximately $145 million in revenue, 145.6, which is almost half of the agency revenues. This is primarily federal funds. Again, $131 million of that is federal funds.
You'll see kind of a difference here in spending was 74% for energy of the total and 47% in revenue. We get a lot of general fund revenues in other areas of the department that kind of skew the revenues and expenditures a little bit. This slide indicates how much commerce generates for the general fund on an annual basis. Commerce is a net revenue generator as a whole to the general fund. In FY18, commerce generated about $112 million to the general fund. The big revenues are in other areas of the department that go into here, including securities and unclaimed property. So not under your jurisdiction, but just trying to give a general insight into the department. Next slide. This specifically gets into expenditures for the Division of Energy Resources. You can see here we've listed out basically the kind of the major program areas. In FY18, the Conservation Improvement Program spent about $4.8 million. $3.4 million of that was for the R&D grants portion of that. These funds are assessed out to the regulated industries, so this is in the special revenue fund, and there's no net cost to the general fund for this program. Energy regulation and planning is funded by the general fund appropriation. Those expenditures are recovered by an assessment on the regulated entities, and they don't also have a general fund. They have a net general fund impact of zero. We have the Environmental Review and Analysis Group, which has about $3.8 million in expenditures. They are funded by assessments on the regulated entities. So you'll see kind of as we walk through these areas, for the most part, the Energy Resources Division doesn't have any general fund or special revenue fund net impact. Obviously, the assessments have an impact on those regulated entities, but not on the state budget as a whole. LIHEAP is the next program. You'll see that this portion here, the $3.2 million, is just the admin budget for the energy assistance program. We'll get into the, in a minute here, we'll talk about the actual grants that are paid out. So this LIHEAP budget is funded by a federal grant. Weatherization is very similar. The $805,000 here is for their admin of that program. And then other services here at the bottom, which is about $7.6 million. The biggest bulk of this is the Made in Minnesota. It's about $3 million of that, which is from the Renewable Development Fund. So, Madam Chair, you'll see here that this is where the pass-through portion or the grant portions of the Energy Assistance Program come in, which is about $117 million. It was $117 million in FY18. And then Weatherization Assistance Program, which is about $7.7 million. And that's the actual grant pass-through dollars that go to citizens for work in their households. And then the last slide here just shows the petrol fund expenditures of $5.7 million. $880,000 of that is operating dollars, and $4.7 million was paid out in claims last year, and $153,000 was spent on abandoned underground storage tank removal. So that's how that breaks out. So that's the end of my testimony. I'll turn it over to John.
Madam Chair, members, Joe and Catherine are here. Joel Fisher is still here, so we'll just kind of keep a musical chair thing going.
Before you leave, there are some questions for you. Representative Baker, did you have a question for the Chief Financial Officer?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. And again, kind of coming back to my further question for Mr. Sullivan. And again, I kind of hone in on the SIP stuff, and I think you had a good presentation here about how much money is collected, about 4.8 through the department. It's a very large part of, I think, the numbers that we saw today. Can you tell me, how do those numbers get generated into the department, about 4.8 million? Where does that money come from?
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, that money comes from assessments on the regulated entities. There's the R&D assessment is approximately $3.6 million a year, and that's parsed out based on factors that are in law, and I believe this is on the, I'd have to look, but I believe it's on how much revenue they generate in a year for this assessment.
And a follow-up, Madam Chair, too, and thank you for that. I, as a previous member of the commission in Willmar and the utilities, I understand SIP and how it's passed on to our users for this purpose, and I've been a supporter of SIP for many years. Do you have any idea, and I know you may not have this information in front of you, what's the revenue look like in the last 10 years? Has that been flat? Has it risen quite a bit? Can you give me an idea of what that looks like over the last 10 years, roughly?
Madam Chair, Representative, it has been flat. There's a cap in statute there's three different sections for the SIP assessment, and there's a cap in statute. So for instance, the R&D portion, I'm certain is $3.6 million, and it's been flat at that basically since inception.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you. Now we have questions for Deputy Commissioner Sullivan, and we start with Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and congratulations to the Deputy Commissioner and Assistant Commissioner. a few questions. The first is, with the low-income heating assistance program, I would presume, given our northern location, that there's a high demand for these services. I know that the federal funding has been relatively flat over the last several years. Curious if we know what the unmet need is in Minnesota for these funds and what the trends are in terms of what we're seeing for applications.
Chair Wiginius, Representative Long, we don't have that information on the tips of our tongues, but we can get that for you, right away. What I can tell you about the low-income program is that the majority of the dollars do go to Greater Minnesota, in particular the northwestern part of the state, and I think it's about 70% of LIHEAP dollars flow into those communities or into rural communities. But we'll get exact numbers for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then a similar question on the weatherization assistance program, if we know what the unmet need is and what we're seeing in terms of trends.
And again, Madam Chair, Representative Long, there is unmet need under the weatherization program. I can get that information for you, for sure.
Thank you. Madam Chair, a couple questions on the conservation improvement program. Wondering if you could characterize for us how much money has been saved over the, or excuse me, how much electricity has been saved over the scope of the program, and then how we might think about that in terms of power plants or other resources that we haven't had to build because of the conservation program.
Madam Chair, Representative Long, thank you for the question. I can answer that. The conservation program has saved ratepayers, I want to say, over the last 15 years, about $6 billion in ratepayer savings. That equates to in 10 power plants that Minnesota has not had to build, and that the analysis shows that for every dollar spent in conservation, that we receive about $4 in benefits. So the program is very successful and has been really the foundation of our clean energy policy in Minnesota. Thank you for the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a follow-up to that. So if we're thinking about 10 power plants that we didn't have to put online, there's been some conversation on the committee about the polar vortex and some of the stresses that can come onto our system in peak times. Curious what, if we know, what would have been the impact if we hadn't have had the conservation programs in terms of the impact of events like this on our grid?
Madam Chair, Representative Long, I think that's a great question. What I can say is that the measures that, and we all know that, during the polar vortex we had supply emergencies, and had SIP and had conservation measures not been in place, we would have been using a lot more natural gas. We don't have that exact number, but I think that's something that is really important, something that can really add to the discussion around conservation going forward, and I'd be happy to look into that and have our staff dig into that, because I think that's a very important important piece of information to see the value of SIP during these peak events. Thank you for the question.
Thank you. I'd appreciate that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next is Representative Baker.
Madam Chair, thank you, and congratulations as well, Joel, on your new position. We've worked together with your former company, with the Center for Energy and Environment, and again, as you know, I'm kind of that SIP guy that really kind of focuses in on the medium to smaller size munis and co-ops. I think, again, in greater Minnesota, we struggle with finding that right balance and right return on investment. And I've always also been a supporter of SIP. I think it's a good program. And I was one of the representatives for the new folks here that last couple of years really wanted to see this report that just recently came out to see what is maybe the SIP 2.0 and how can we make it look like it's a better program, more robust, new technology. Again, I say that you really can't buy any refrigerators or appliances anymore that are not energy efficient. And part of this was driven by our demands to do these kind of work. And so I think that in Minnesota, we should celebrate that moment that we have come to get rid of a number of plants. I'm not sure I buy the 10, but it's a savings, and I will absolutely recognize that. One of the questions I have, though, for you, Commissioner, is that as you enter this new role, and it's a massive role that you now have over our utilities around Minnesota, and I want to make sure that we can talk about this, and we can further talk about this later offline, but just that as you enter this now with the report that's been given by your old company, it wasn't the kind of results I guess I was maybe looking for as a holistic approach. And I want to just really pass on a message from my utilities and others that I've visited with in greater Minnesota, is that they're still having a harder time finding that fruit. I don't want to say low-hanging anymore, because they're all reaching higher up. And we're finding savings, and we're going to continue to do that. But I want to make sure that a comment to me last 2 years ago here that was significant was that, again, back in the day, Great River Energy was concerned that it was flipping around and it was costing more than what it was saving. And I think we have to be very careful about the $3.6 million that are assessed to customers, that is still getting us that fair and viable return on investment. I want to continue the program. I just want to make sure you in your new role, you have to also hear what we have to say in greater Minnesota and what's important on that return on investment, because we want to support this. But I will tell you in some of those outlying areas, those departments are not as busy as they should be. They need more tools. They need more ideas. But we also want to make sure they aren't just put in automatic pilot and forgotten about, and we're not getting that same return because our rates are going up too fast in Minnesota. And this is just a little part of that. I just wanted to make that comment to you, Commissioner, and welcome you. And again, I look forward to working with you in the future. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, thank you for that. I appreciate the comments, and it has, I've enjoyed working with you over the past couple of years. So thank you for those comments.
One of the things in the report that I think would be helpful for you to comment on, and then for us and for you to elaborate on at some point, is that if smaller co-ops and munis get together, and they can be far more effective. And am I correct in remembering that as part of the report?
Madam Chair, the aggregation of communities is a way for those communities to deliver programs and services that may not be available if they're just on their own. That is something that can be done. You see some of the successful programs, like for instance, SMPA, Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. They aggregate their programs. I believe Missouri River Energy Services also does. They aggregate their programs, and they deliver the same high-quality SIP programs in Preston as they do in Rochester. So that is a recommendation from the study, and it is one of the ways that we can help those smaller utilities, get the benefits of scale to deliver high-quality programs. And also to give them flexibility. And I will also say, that we're committed to helping all communities throughout the state with the flexibility that they need.
Yes. I think Council can help us right now a little bit on the assessment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to cite a statute. Representative Baker brought this up regarding, you know, cost-effective energy investments that are made under SIP. And the statute, one of the statutes under SIP says that an association or utility is not required to make energy conservation investments to attain the energy savings goals of the subdivision that are not cost-effective, even if the investment is necessary to attain the energy savings goals.
I think that's a helpful to keep in mind.
Madam Chair, if I could just ask Mr. Eloff one question. So for that particular utility, if it's not cost-effective, are they still passing on the assessments to the customer?
Excuse me, Madam Chair, Representative Baker, the assessments, I'm sorry, which assessments are you speaking of?
It was the SIP assessment that I think we had talked about earlier, the 3.6%, $3.6 million in the state.
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, I know the answer to that.
Thank you.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question would probably be maybe best suited for Commissioner Kelly. Is he available for questioning?
He
I know he was here earlier today.
We knew he could only be here for a few minutes, and we appreciated him coming to start us off.
Okay, well, I'll let the folks from the department maybe kind of let it float around. I do have a couple, maybe specific to the CFO a little bit later, but, you know, earlier this week, there was a press release from Governor Waltz, and it, you know, talked about the Enbridge Line 3 litigation, and, you know, I think he was quoted as saying, you know, projects like these don't only need a building permit to go forward, they also need a social permit. And, you know, just from a, I think you're kind of the lead agency that's, you know, taking this under your wing. I think this is the appropriate place to maybe discuss this. But, you know, kind of what could you explain? You know, I was looking through this, the packet that you handed out. It's very good. Thank you. But kind of what is a social permit? And, you know, where in statute could I kind of find that?
I think that is an appropriate question for somebody from the Walls office, and we can ask them to come and talk to us about that if you would like.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure who the commissioners were appointed by.
Okay.
Who were they appointed?
Well, the commissioners were obviously appointed by Walls, but that I don't know that that decision. If you would like to comment on it, certainly you may do that, but I think maybe we would need to talk to somebody, if Commissioner Kelly isn't here, talk to somebody else.
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, I guess what I would add to that is I think that the what Governor Walz was thinking is that that the when he made that comment is that there's a process, and the process is what seeing the process through to its completion is what will is what answers that question, and that's the way we view continuing on in the lawsuit.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just you know, we talk about process and we talk about completion. How many other energy-related projects that go to the PUC and have approval are not considered incomplete after they've been approved?
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, I mean, there are, you know, the PUC obviously is a critically important voice, but there are appeals of the PUC's decision. That is very common. And, you know, the PUC is, you know, they are obviously the, you know, the critically important in the decision and the permitting of a large energy project. But, you know, there are appeals to the court because the PUC is ultimately subject to the court's jurisdiction and the court's understanding of the statutes.
Madam Chair, members, so just kind of a kind of look moving forward. So, you know, if I were a wind project developer or a shrimp farmer, you know, you guys as a department are kind of our lead. You can sell our state. You can say, hey, this is a great place to do business. You know, just kind of with this coming under, we've lost shrimp. Now we're trying to, you know, scare Enbridge after they've jumped through all the hoops. You know, if I were to, you know, ask you for a commercial and say, hey, I want to attract you to the state, kind of what would be your pitch? You know, here's a set of rules. You jump through all the rules. You know, is it going to be like a, you know, commercial with hopscotch, or kind of just kind of go through that? I mean, I know this is not you. You're brand new. I wish Mr. Commissioner Kelly was here, or even someone from the administration or his office itself were here. But just kind of, I mean, what would be your pitch? Like, I mean, do you think this is kind of creating a confusing situation for business as we move forward?
Madam Chair, Representative Switzinski, it's a difficult question for me to answer. I guess what I would say is that, you know, the Governor's Office, the Department of Commerce, are committed to seeing this through, and we're committed to the process. And I'm sorry I can't answer the question directly, but that's my response.
Madam Chair. And then just kind of one, so when you do lose to the POC again, because they have done what they need to do, is the departments, or you can just ask this question as you run it up the poll, is your plan to go back to the Court then of Appeals, because you've been thrown out because they said you essentially haven't, you know, exhausted all your attempts of appeal to the POC? Will you then, at that point when you lose, go back to the Court of Appeals to continue this, or will you say, you know what, we're going to allow Minnesota to modernize its piping system in the state?
Madam Chair, Representative Switzinski, you know, right now, you know, we're committed to moving forward, you know, with the petition for reconsideration.
Okay, thank you. And then I just have one to the CFO, Janke, just kind of a question on budgetary stuff, too. Thank you. And if you just need to run it up the poll, too, at some point, that's great. You know, I was looking at your budget and kind of the, you know, different programs. Like, do you have, you know, when you're allotting funds for fighting things that maybe aren't in policy or actually in statute, I mean, is there a place that for where these funds come from, special area to fight this, because we have one state agency fighting another? Is there kind of an auxiliary program that the agency sets money aside to do these battles within itself?
Madam Chair, Representative, we don't have a special pot of money in the general fund or anywhere else for that. So,
all right, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. And then we're going to hear from the Public Utilities Commission.
Madam Chair, I'd like to go back to the SIP. I'm a little confused when you brought up how agencies or munis and co-ops could combine to do a better job or whatever. I'm not entirely sure what it is. Is that so they can do bigger projects, or because that's the only, you didn't quite explain what they would have done when they combined their pieces.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, sorry about that. I sometimes can drop into kind of wonkish lingo pretty quickly, so sorry. But, you know, if you look at historically how our munis and co-ops have developed in order to generate power, they have aggregated into, like, our cooperatives have aggregated, and they're now owners of Great River Energy. So that's how they take the benefits of power, is by aggregating and having Great River purchase power plants for them collectively. And the munis have done the same thing through their joint action agencies, like Missouri River Energy Services is a collection of 67 cities that work together. Forgive me, MRES, if that's not quite the right number, but it's something around that number. And what they can do, those joint action agencies and Great River Energy, they can pool collectively conservation as well and deliver programs to all of their members. In the same way that they deliver power services to their members or transmission services, they can pool and make access to programs, conservation programs, available to all their members. So like SMPA, which is in southeastern Minnesota, they will operate those conservation programs. So if you're say you live in Preston, and there's only 5,000 people who live in Preston, if you are a homeowner and you want to find out if you can get a home energy audit, you go to Preston Public Utilities, and on Preston Public Utilities webpage or through their utility manager, they will link you directly through to SMPA, who will then provide you the program services that you're looking for. I hope that answers the question. Maybe not.
You probably need to take it back to the office so you can explain it. I'm just a simple pipe fitter, and I sometimes don't understand the ins and outs. And I will comment to Representative Swazinski's, and I said it in the Energy Committee for a number of years, I have significant lower-income families that live along the rail lines and have hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of gallons of high volatile fuel running through my district. Approximately 15 to 20,000 low-income families or people, three elementary schools, four playgrounds live within the blast zone of that rail line. And we have rail cars, single wall pipe, or single wall steel, because we know that the railroads are able to go to the federal government and get delays on a dual lined tankers. They don't have to change the valves that have safety cutoffs on them. So if the tanker falls off the rail and explodes, the fuel lines are still connected to all the other tankers. So I won't use as harsh a language as I did last year, but I will say that every year that this pipeline, which is hundreds of times safer than the rail cars, continue to be delayed, you are putting the lives of young children, mothers and fathers, the playgrounds, the schools, at risk. So I don't think it's people have not known my stance on this, and I am disappointed in the governor's and the commissioner's and the department's decision to prolong this particular piece. And as a pipe fitter, I get to preview the wonderful Facebook and other things, social media posts that I'm sure people with white-collar jobs don't bother to take a look at. And this has inflamed a whole group of people. I hope that we don't have an accident in my district. Maybe somebody else's district.
Well, thank you. I wasn't necessarily going to get involved in this debate, but first of all, I strongly agree with Representative Mahoney's analysis of rail issues. That's why we brought a major rail safety initiative in 2014. But there are also risks with pipelines, and there are also regulatory loopholes. And I think this is not a choice between the two. It's a choice of, lessening our reliance on fossil fuels. You know, we can get into a whole debate. You know, the rails are not going in the same place the pipelines are, et cetera. So I think the issue here is, and why I do agree with the governor, and I want to be on record since this was raised, is the Department of Commerce had an issue with need. And that's what we're talking about here. And so I think we have to address both rail safety and the question of need for pipelines in the broader context of our energy policy. So I didn't want to get into it, but since it was raised, I wanted to get on the record saying that.
Thank you.
And thanks to the Department of Commerce for laying out your program. It's going to help us no end as the budget is rolled out. So appreciate your coming. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
We will now hear from the Public Utilities Commissioner, Commissioner Dan Lipschultz. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Chair Wagenius. My name is Dan Lipschultz. I'm a member of the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. I'm what's called the vice chair, which is not an official position under statute, but it's a position the commission years ago created so that we have someone at the election of all the commissioners who can fill in when the chair is not available. And as you know, our chair, Nancy Lang, departed the commission. We have a vacancy that is waiting to be filled. So you have me today to talk a little bit about what the commission does. My presentation is going to be very brief, describing who we are and what we do. And first of all, let me say with me today are Dan Wolf, our executive secretary, our administrative head, and Commissioner Sieben, our newest commissioner, but I think you were appointed, was it 2 years ago now?
Yes.
Okay, so that's new on the commission. So we're a five-member board. Quasi-judicial decision-making board is usually the way we're described. All five of us are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate to staggered six-year terms. They're all full-time positions, and that shouldn't be surprising, although some folks ask. We have about 600 pending cases in front of us. We issue about 320 orders every year, 120 of which are formal contested orders. So like a court, we have a full docket that never ends year to year. We don't have a season. It's a 365-day enterprise at the commission. The qualifications of the commission, they're pretty limited as to what's required to be appointed to the commission. We can't have any more than three members of one political party. At least one of the commissioners has to reside outside the Twin Cities metropolitan areas, like seven-county area. And the governor is required to consider certain things in the appointment, but none of these are binding, and I've listed them here. The governor is required to consider folks who are learned in the law, in engineering, finance, utility property evaluation, and also folks who are generally representative of the public. We're not a cabinet-level agency. We don't operate in conjunction with the administration. We're actually independent of the administration. And to give you a sense of how that is operationalized, we don't communicate with the governor's office. The chair never has on any pending matters, and I don't believe ever will. That would really be inappropriate. We're appointed to be an independent board to reflect and implement the laws that you folks pass. We have 55 staff people. That includes both administrative staff and analysts and lawyers. We have a budget of about $7.4 million per year from the general fund, but importantly, like you heard with the department, just about 100% of that amount is recovered through fees assessed to the utilities. Therefore, it's returned to the general fund, and we don't actually then draw on the general fund, even though we're limited by the general fund budget allocated to us. So here's a sense of the scope of our work. Most of our work you can see in the first bullet point, and it's regulating investor-owned electric and distribution gas utilities. There are three investor-owned utilities in Minnesota. Xcel Energy is the one you have probably heard of the most, Otter Tail Power, and Minnesota Power. We also regulate, there are really four main distribution gas utilities, investor-owned utilities in the state. Xcel and CenterPoint are the two you probably hear about the most. Merck and Great Plains are another two in more rural areas of the state. When it comes to gas and electric utilities, we're regulating their rates and their services. And the general charge when we regulate their rates is to make sure those rates are just and reasonable, and also to make sure they're not unjustly discriminatory. One of the foundations of utility regulation is equity. And the not unjustly discriminatory standard is an outgrowth of that. We also represent, we also regulate their services, and the general edict is to make sure that service is sufficiently reliable. What does that mean? Well, it's a high standard. You need to know that the lights are going to turn on, the air conditioning is going to turn on, and the heat's going to turn on when you need it. And as we just experienced through the polar vortex, that's not to be taken lightly. We also, when it comes to electric utilities, regulate their infrastructure in a really profound way. We are actually the final arbiter in deciding what resources a utility is going to use to generate the electricity that it uses to provide electric service to Minnesotans. We determine ultimately not only the type but the size and the timing of the deployment of those generation resources, and we also have final authority over the transmission facilities that are built to deliver that power to the distribution facilities that ultimately connect up with our homes and our businesses. And we do that in any number of ways. We have, I think, what you might have heard of, integrated resource plan proceedings. And those are the proceedings where a utility comes to us with a 15-year plan, and embedded in that is a 5-year action plan. And they lay out the mix of generation resources and transmission that they intend over the next 15 years. Now, there's a stakeholder process that the commission, that the utilities go through before it even comes to us. So when we get a proposed resource plan from a utility, it already has, to some extent, it already reflects input from a number of stakeholders across the spectrum. But ultimately, then, we will decide whether to approve or modify the mix of generation resources that they have proposed and the transmission facilities that would go along with that. And then, once we've approved an integrated resource plan with that generation mix and the transmission in it over a 15-year and a 5-year horizon, ultimately, if it's a large energy facility that a utility needs to build to deliver that energy, there is something called a certificate of need proceeding at the commission, where the commission will ultimately decide whether we will grant a certificate for the particular facility they seek to build pursuant to the integrated resource plan we will have previously approved. And that would be a large generation facility. It could be transmission facilities of a certain size, which for the most part is most of the high voltage transmission lines in the state. And then there's another category beyond the gas and electric utilities who we regulate, but on a very limited basis. And one would be non-utility large energy infrastructure providers. And you've been talking about Line 3. One of the areas that comes up are large petroleum pipelines, which are subject to our certificate of need authority that I just mentioned earlier. If you want to build a large energy facility, you have to demonstrate need, and that need is determined by the commission under specific statutes and rules, and of course a record developed in each proceeding. We also, to a limited extent, would grant certificates of need for large wind and or solar facilities. But if those wind or solar facilities are being proposed pursuant to renewable energy standards, then they're not required to get a certificate of need. We also regulate landline telephone companies. If you go back 20 years ago when I first started in this business, there was a lot of regulation of landline telephone service, and there is today very little because of changes in statute. This legislature has over time dramatically reduced the amount of regulatory oversight the commission has over landline telecommunications carriers, and as we sit here today, our authority is essentially only complaint-based and does not extend to determining or regulating the prices or rates that telecommunications companies charge. So what's the purpose of commission regulation in the first place? And I thought I wanted to just touch on this briefly. And I think it's probably obvious to everybody. It's because these gas and electric utility services in particular are essential services. Water is another one, but we don't regulate it. Gas and electric, which are generally not provided for the most part through municipalities like water, are essential services that everybody depends on. Our economy depends on it. Businesses and individual residential and small business consumers depend on it. And they depend on it, as everybody knows, for their daily lives and also for their very lives. And again, coming back to the polar vortex or a hot summer day, people can lose their lives if they don't have reliable, affordable electric and gas service available to them. And our obligation essentially is to implement the statutes that you write as you intend them to be implemented. That's not always easy, and it sounds like when I say that, that it's just formulaic, and everybody here knows it's not. But that's our charge, is to try to deduce what you want done and to implement what you want us to do. And obviously what you want done is also run through the administration to the extent this, the executive branch is also involved in the formulation of legislation and the statutes that we enforce. As a general matter, we have a general directive to ensure just, reasonable, and non-discriminatory rates and service and reliable service. But as part of that, increasingly, we're also required to consider a number of other very specific directives. And in the electric utility space, what that really means now is we're not just looking at making sure that we have reliable, affordable service, but we're also looking to make sure we have clean energy produced to provide that service. And Minnesota has been on a long-standing path for really about the last 15 years in that direction. And we've made some remarkable achievements, and I'd be happy to discuss that with you if you have questions about it. Again, I want to describe the nature of our process, what we are and what we do. We're essentially a quasi-judicial agency, and what that means is we make decisions for the most part on a case-by-case basis. And our decisions are based solely on the record. They have to be. And they're developed, in a sense, with no communications that we identify here as ex parte communications with parties to our proceedings. We function effectively like a court, making case-by-case decisions based on the record, and our communications with parties on any pending matters before us are limited to on-the-record discussions that are recorded with all the other parties present. We're also subject to the open meeting law, and here's an instance in which we're not like a court, because courts behind the scenes, the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court, they can talk with one another about the cases that before them, even though they can't talk with parties. We can't talk with parties, but we can't really talk with each other either, because like a city council, we're subject to the open meeting law. So all of our meetings have to be in public, in publicly noticed open meetings. No more than two, meaning you can't have a quorum, can discuss any of those pending matters or any material issue in those pending matters. And finally, at the end of the day, all of our decisions are issued in written orders, very formal orders drafted by our lawyers, reviewed by the commissioners before they go out. And that's it. Again, I'd be happy to answer any questions about what we do, how we do it, and to the extent I can touch on cases you want to ask about, I'd be happy to do that too, as would Commissioner Sieben.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I just add something, please? It came up earlier.
Can you put your name on the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Katie Sieben, a commissioner at the Public Utilities Commission. It came up earlier in the testimony about the extreme weather that Minnesota faced earlier or late last month. And I just wanted to mention that the commission is going to hold a public hearing, as Commissioner Lipschultz mentioned. Our meetings are held in public. It will be noticed. But later this month, in a couple weeks, the commission will have a planning meeting with the gas and electric utilities of the state, as well as MISO, the Independent Service Organization for the Midwest region, to talk about the service quality impacts that happened a couple weeks ago. So I just wanted to make you all aware of that and know that reliability of as Commissioner Lipschultz said, reliability across the state of Minnesota is a critical component of our role in protecting the public, and so we are going to be questioning the utilities about the service interruptions that happened.
Thank you. That is an excellent point. I appreciate you bringing it up. Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Vice Chair Lipschultz, and welcome back to the legislature, Commissioner Sieben. One question I have is, when you are reviewing some of the guidelines that the legislature has put out, we've established as a state a greenhouse gas reduction target. Curious how that factors into your considerations when you are doing your work, such as reviewing some of the plans that utilities are proposing.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Long. I can tell you that in resource plan proceedings where we sort out the mix of resources, we're actually required by law to consider the greenhouse gas reduction goals. And in addition to that, we have statutes that establish mandates. And that's not just mandates to achieve certain targets for renewable energy, but we actually have a renewable energy preference provision in the statutes. So when we're sorting out and trying to determine the least cost mix of energy resources, we're required to give first preference to renewable energy unless it's proven on the record that the renewable sources cannot achieve the ends necessary to ensure affordable, reliable service. So there are a lot of things in the goals that are included, and I can tell you that the electric sector in Minnesota is on target to meet the carbon reduction goals so far. It's really the transportation sector that sets the state back to the point where it's hard to see how the state can meet those carbon reduction goals. I'm not suggesting that there isn't more work to be done in the energy side. I'm just saying that the energy sector is on a very good track right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just add a comment that the research that I've seen and estimates that I've seen are that the utility sector is going to have to pick up a larger percentage of achieving the greenhouse gas reduction goals in some of the other sectors, given the difficulty of reaching those goals in some of the other sectors. Second question is on the community solar program. This is something that I know the Commission has devoted a substantial amount of time to getting right, and I'm curious if you could just talk a little bit about some of what's gone into the work that you've done in the community solar program over the last few years and some of the adjustments you've made.
Madam Chair, Representative Long, you're right, we've put a lot of time into that, and we're going to have, I think within the next year or two, at least 600 megawatts of solar garden capacity online delivering service. As far as I know, there are a handful of states, other states that have solar garden programs, and I believe the state that might come closest to us may have 50 megawatts of solar garden capacity online. So if you measure our solar garden program by the amount of solar on the system, it's been an astounding success. The concern, of course, is the cost, because the rates that are essentially associated with the solar gardens are up, you know, around 12, 13, 14 cents per kilowatt hour. And you can get solar now on a utility scale at 5-6 cents a kilowatt hour. Now, there are attributes of distributed generation that solar gardens serve that change that calculus a little bit. You get benefits and cost savings by putting solar out into the distribution system. So I'm not suggesting that that differential I mentioned holds once you actually look deeper into the numbers. But the balance that we struggle with, and I think that all of you have to struggle with, is not, I don't think, between renewables or no renewables, but it's what's the most efficient, lowest cost method of delivering renewables to the system. And so that was one concern I think that I think a lot of folks have about solar gardens so far. Another concern I think is the extent to which solar gardens have largely gone to serve commercial customers, and there really hasn't been the kind of solar garden deployment that I think a lot of the individuals who started the solar garden program envisioned. I think a lot of folks envision getting solar gardens out into communities, into sort of poor and passed over areas, using rooftops, and that really hasn't been the form it's taken. It's generally taken the form of relatively large solar arrays in relatively rural areas, and then connecting to the distribution system and delivering most of the output to commercial customers and signing up a number of residential customers as well. So if you measure it by the number of customers, there are a lot of residential customers who are going to be served by it. But I think one of the criticisms we've heard is that a lot of the capacity is going to commercial customers. So it's been a resounding success in that it has delivered a lot more solar into the system. But there are some concerns, I think, about the cost and about whether it's really reaching into the communities it was intended to reach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate those comments. I think when we're talking about costs, too, we need to be a little more global than the rate that is being paid by customers. You mentioned some of the distributed generation benefits. There's also health benefits in terms of infrastructure and other costs that are avoided if we're building renewable energy. So I think those are costs we need to be considering as well. And I'll pass on that.
Just so I understand correctly, it sounds to me like you are measuring community solar against the rest of renewables not against the whole system. Did I understand that correctly?
Madam Chair, I think what I was saying is I was really comparing community solar garden costs to utility scale solar, larger solar that's not essentially distributed, but on a larger scale, the equivalent of a wind farm. And what we've seen, at least in the numbers, and it's not surprising, there are economies of scale associated with larger facilities. You can get much lower cost solar on a utility scale than you can on a distributed scale. But I want to sort of caution all of us to, I think, Representative Long's point, that there are advantages and values that flow from distributed generation. Solar gardens is one form of that. An individual rooftop solar is another form. And so I was simply comparing the per kilowatt hour cost of a solar garden versus utility scale solar. But understanding, as I said before, there are benefits you get from distributed generation that aren't necessarily reflected in that differential I mentioned, which I think Representative Long was your point, and it's a good one.
So I think I'm now correct in hearing that you measure community solar against other solar, not community solar against the whole system of production of electricity.
Madam Chair, I think we do look at it actually in juxtaposed next to the entire system. But, you know, our charge under the solar garden statute is really pretty narrow. Everything I just talked about was really set out in the statute. And the statute told us what rates need to be charged. And they essentially laid out the conditions, the size permitted, and so forth. So my point, I think, is that when you implement the statute as written as we have, you end up with a per kilowatt hour cost for distributed solar garden capacity higher than you'd get if you had the same amount through a utility scale solar program, with the caveat that the cost differential may not be as wide as I said once you actually factor in savings and benefits you get from putting something into the distribution network.
Madam Chair, just one more question. So just a couple comments and one question. First is that when we're talking size, if you're comparing the utility scale to the community solar is capped at 1 megawatt, so you're not able to get some of the advantages of the size.
Yep.
The other point I'd just make is in terms of the progress we've made with 600 megawatts, it seems highly unlikely to me that as a state we would have moved that fast had it not been for the community solar program. And so I think we should take that benefit into consideration when we're talking about the overall program. And the question I have is when we're talking about the comparative costs, the commission has implemented a value of solar approach, which is intended to ensure that there is no cross-subsidization and that we're achieving the real rate that the solar gardens are expected to provide. So the theory is that if value of solar is working correctly, then we should be able to purchase as much solar on our system at that rate as the market will support, and that we should be agnostic to that. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Long, yes. And I can tell you that the vast majority of that 600 megawatts came in under the applicable retail rate standard that applied until we had a value of solar rate in place. So that's an excellent point. So the rate has come down as a result of what we have now implemented. And what we've now implemented is that value of solar rate you're talking about. So in theory, you should end up neutral.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We have not too much time, but we have three folks on the list. Representative Baker is next.
Madam Chair, thank you, Commissioners, for both being here. You're the courts of energy, really, and you make the rules work with legislation that we pass. And I want to come back to solar in just one second, but your meetings are held here. Is it a monthly public utility meeting to the public? Is that how that works?
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, we actually meet weekly. We have what we call an agenda meeting almost every Thursday morning with rare exceptions, and sometimes we'll have more than one meeting or more than one agenda meeting. And in each agenda meeting, we'll have anywhere from 4 to 15 items. So all of our meetings, or almost all of them, are in St. Paul, but starting about a year and a half ago, we began to take our meetings out into communities because we were hearing, and I think understandably so, from folks that we were too metro-centric and we weren't really reaching out into the communities so they could at least see what we do. And we have been in, I think now, Dan, five?
Six.
Well, six.
Duluth, I guess. So five different
communities. We've been in five different communities, from Parker's Prairie to Duluth to Rochester.
To Marshall.
And we have found it to be really fruitful. We've gone out into communities and have folks approached us that we've heard about what you've done, but we've never actually been able to see it. We've had utility employees come to us and say, you know, we always heard from our folks here about all the stuff you're doing and the requirements you impose, and but it was good to actually see you in action. And so it's been a we plan to continue to do that and do more of it.
And follow up, Madam Chair, that was where I was getting to, and thank you for taking them on the road. I think if you have roughly 52 meetings a year, if it's weekly, if we can get a number of those in Greater Minnesota, we as rural members and customers, and we need to hear from you too. So thank you for doing that. And I want to follow back to the solar comments that we're making. And I appreciate your comments. I think you're saying at the utility level, we do have a bit of an unbalance here or a potential imbalance with solar production here in Minnesota. I'm a solar friend and I want to see this continue. However, my concern is if we don't start looking at who's building these utility-scale solars and who's making the money and what the rates are really costing our customers, we're going to get out of kilter. So I think our work in the legislature over the years of building this program has been very successful. I think this year we are tasked, members, to do some tweaking to our work so that we actually can have some reasonable caps that we can still see grow, but let's have companies come to us and be competitive with what gives us the best value while still exploring and expanding solar. So I just want to make that comment. We are losing, and you know, and members, I think we've seen this before, we're losing our price advantage here in Minnesota from the rest of the country over the last 15 years. We were really kind of lower on the scale. Our red line now is meeting the other line, and our advantage of that cost is gone. We can also celebrate that we've got clean air too and clean energy. That's better. We just have to always keep that in mind. So you might see this again, Madam Chair. That was my statement for today. So thank you for that.
We have two other folks who would like to ask questions in just a minute or two left. So Representative Bierman and Representative Spasinski, and then we'll end.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here. I think about you now all the time when I turn the lights off more and more frequently, and seeing, having learned about the scope of all the work you do, thank you for that. So my question, some of it was just discussed, so I'll skip down since we have limited time, but I just wondered, how often do you have to change the plans that the utility companies make if they're doing a 15-year plan and energy is changing so rapidly? And what sort of pushback do you have there, or are you more dictatorial and tell them what to produce? And then second question is, 15 years isn't that far away, and I'm wondering about the nuclear power plants. Those are set to be about to their end of life in the mid-30s, and I'm just wondering if those are still on the table to be retrofitted and reused, or where that stands. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, utilities file 15-year plans, but they file a plan every 2 years. So it's an iterative, constantly evolving process. And in each plan, there's also a 5-year action plan. That's the plan you can count on happening with some precision. But the 15-year plan is something that gets adjusted every 2 years. So it's a bit of a moving target, but you can see trends. For example, if you look out 15 years right now, all of the most recently approved IRPs for the three investor-owned utilities, in 2030, just 11 years from now, 46% of their energy is going to come from renewable sources. And that's a trend. That's not going to go down. That could even go higher. Right now, we get about 41% of our energy from coal. That's down from around 65% just 14 years ago. That's going to be down to around 22% in 11 years. And it could be even lower as these plans evolve over time. And to the cost point Representative Baker made, I'll sort of point out that wind comes in at 2 cents per kilowatt hour, and solar is dropping rapidly. And so you can see the writing on the wall. Renewable energy becomes an economic imperative as well as an environmental imperative as you move forward. You just need to make sure the system is balanced enough so that it can be reliable and affordable. And these cost or price trends, it's tricky because a lot of it, when you compare one state to another, is a matter of timing. You can have a crossover point where your rates are a reflection of some big old plants being retired at the same time you're adding the new plants. And then when the dust settles over time and the old plants are no longer in rate base being recovered from ratepayers, then, you know, you're left with lower rates eventually. And I think we're seeding things in a good way here in Minnesota in that over time, as we make this transition, we should be left with lower cost power that's still reliable. I don't know, and I can't tell you what the exact mix will be. Coal is eventually going away over time. There will be some natural gas on the system, a lot of wind and a lot of renewable. Hopefully there will be more storage to help balance out the system. It's an exciting time, but we need to proceed carefully and prudently, and I think we're getting there.
And the last question from Representative Straczynski, very quickly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to kind of a follow-up question, and I'll make a statement at the end. But so we've got 600 megawatts potentially of community solar coming up. If you could get back to the committee just on what percentage of that will be corporately owned. So as you have maybe a Target and a Shopko each owning 40% and someone else each in 20, just so as a percentage of that generation, what will be corporately owned, and then what will be actually owned by someone that lives in a house? And then the other follow-up is just, we had a good conversation on Enbridge Line 3, Madam Chair, and I would just encourage, whether you're someone that lives along the tracks, railroad tracks, and Representative Mahoney's district or a county commissioner up in Pennington County, I think this would be a great place to have a conversation about what's going on and just bring it to the forefront so that maybe we could, hear about those issues just at a future date. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Straczynski. We have a quorum, and Representative Christensen moved the minutes of February 7th. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposition? Minutes are approved. Meeting is adjourned. All right.